My name is Gary Posner, and I'm Vice President for Academic Affairs. And on behalf of ASMSU, I'd like to welcome you to the first of the Great Issues Series lectures. In this series, ASMSU will present speakers who will express their viewpoints concerning contemporary, controversial, or informative topics that will be of educational value to you, the students of Michigan State. LSD, God, Man, and Law, the topic of today's speech, will be discussed by an ex-Harvard professor whom Dr. Richard Alpert has called the most creative thinker in the psychedelic field. It will be discussed by a man who is appealing a 30-year prison sentence. It will be discussed by the man who was given a 4,000-acre estate on which to continue his work. It will be discussed by the man who has said, LSD is not a narcotic and not a medical drug. It doesn't cure any illness. It is a new form of energy. It will be discussed by the man who has said that the effects of an LSD session are highly individualistic, highly unpredictable. The topic will be discussed by a man who believes in what he is fighting for despite heavy opposition. It will be discussed by a man whose personal life has been drastically changed in recent years due to his involvement with LSD. On behalf of ASMSU, I'd like to present Dr. Timothy Leary.
I should like to begin with a word about prayer. Those of us who have worked with LSD and have found ourselves catapulted out of our minds down strange evolutionary tissue corridors beyond the 20th century have learned a thing or two about prayer. The first thing we have learned is that you cannot pray with your mind. You have to be out of your mind to pray. When you're in your mind, you can wish, you can hope, you can beg, you can request, but your mind can't contact the divinity or the grandeur of the evolutionary process. We have come to believe that only those out of their minds can pray. Psychotics can pray. Flipped out saints can pray. Psychedelics can pray. You can't pray for health. You can't pray for wealth. You can't pray for a victory on the football field. I can, however, being in my mind at this time, hope that you win Saturday and wish you well. I shall begin now by telling you of an unusual event that I was involved in about 2 months ago. I got in a car from my home and drove to New York. And in the presence of about 40 or 50 members of the press and mass media, I announced the formation of a new religion. Now, 25 years ago, I was a college undergraduate. I was sitting, as you are today, in rooms like this. I must admit, not quite this large. And I was listening to the graying men of our society, the wise men or the would-be holy men, come before us and tell about their professions. Most of them were doing what I'm doing today, trying to explain how they make a living, to defend what they're doing, perhaps to interest the undergraduates in pursuing their career. Now, the problem was for me 25 years ago that no place in the college catalog were there courses, nor in the occupational counseling centers were there anyone who could tell me how I could pursue the particular career that I now find myself in. Now, of course, everything is taped out in the college catalog. Dear robots, from astronomy and aerodynamics down to zoology, whatever career society offers you, it's pretty well spelled out for you. If you want to go into politics, you study government and law, and then after you graduate, you join one of the two parties. And with a little hard work and some luck, you might get to be congressman or senator, or perhaps the president of the United States. You can study literature or science, and perhaps you'll win the Nobel Prize. Medicine, pre-med, medical school. In 10 years, you'll have your Cadillac. You might even pick out that holiest of professions, graduate school, assistant professor, associate professor, and then reach that pinnacle of lofty eminence, full professor. Interestingly enough, although any undergraduate would consider it eccentric to pursue a career that would involve starting a new religion, the college majors who would find this most extraordinary and most shocking would be those in divinity school, because here we deal not with eccentricity, but possibly even heresy. So I come back as a 25-year graying graduate to tell you about my profession. Now, one of the problems is that in the yellow pages of our telephone directory, my profession isn't even listed, which I take to be testimony for the profanation and secularization of the American culture. At other times, my profession has been called shaman, or guru, or alchemist, or sorcerer, hermetic scholar. My profession is the alteration of consciousness, the systematic changing of the levels of reality, the disciplined and systematic mapping and charting and controlling of the many levels of consciousness which are available to members of our species. Now, during my talk, I'm going to mention some famous members of my trade union. I don't want you to think that I'm comparing myself with these eminent and distinguished holy men of the past. Like any other profession, there are many fools and conformists and drudges, just like any other trade union. Those of you who are studying in the College of Police Science would mention J. Edgar Hoover as one of your ideals. I'll be mentioning some of my ideals, some of the men of the past who have pursued the road that I am pursuing, with no attempt to compare myself to them, but that's where I'd like to go. And I want to say this, that my profession is extremely orthodox. It's one of the most ancient professions known to man. We have our laws, we have our customs, we have our regular procedures and sequences of when we should do this and when we should do that. The members of my profession always have the same goal. We seek to reaffirm the divinity of the individual human being. We seek to get man out of the manacles of his mind so that he can come to his senses, resurrect his body, and find the revelation and wisdom which is buried within his body. Now, in my profession, it's not always the time to start a new religion. There are sometimes when seeds are planted, there's a time to prune, There's a time to harvest. There are four factors or characteristics that have to be present in order to define the time that you start a new religion. There has to be a hunger and a terrible need in the society for a new meaning. That's number one. Second, you have to have a new sacrament or a new method which works to bring man back to his senses and to resurrect his body. Third, you have to have a new metaphor, a new model, a new language to describe and communicate the new meaning. And fourth, and quite important, you have to have a political situation which is ready, but still is going to allow the thing to occur. Now, I want to take up these four factors in starting a new religion in a little more detail. It's time to start a new religion when the society has become so static, so stabilized, so robotized, that the life is being lost. Now, to many of us, American society today is an insane asylum. It's completely beyond any rational or natural bounds of harmony and sense. I was on a radio program in Boston last night, and I made a statement of this sort, and it was one of these telephone quiz things, and a lady called up and said, well, in other words, you're saying that everyone is nuts but you. And I thought about that for a minute because it was a good point, and I had to say, believe it or not, lady, people in my profession have to say that. Visionary prophets are just stuck with that particular line and have to live with it. Now, do I really have to go down the list of symptoms to support my contention that things are really pretty bad today? See, the problem is that the members of these huge national or international lunatic asylums are so built into the system that you can't realize, you know, how crazy it is. In Rome, the Turkish Empire, and the Brahmanical society of 4,000 years ago, it all gets zipped up so tight, it all gets so conditioned that you just can't pull yourself out of it to see, you know, how really mad it is. Like a fish doesn't know he's swimming in water, we can't see how implausible this network is that we find ourselves in. No. Now look at the war situation. There are two groups, each of whom are well-meaning, completely convinced of their virtue. Aging men in capitals, both east and west, are sending young seed-carrying men far from home to murder each other. Aging and probably impotent men, both east and west, are lovingly handling huge cylindrical shiny tubes of power, wondering when, now. Or the racial situation. See, we're so close to that. We talk about white backlash and these cliches. It becomes just a conditioned reflex, another game like baseball. The newspapers keep giving us new twists, but, you know, it's just madness. But the real insanity and the real pathology of our culture is what has been done to human consciousness. Now, the neurological and the biogenetic fact of the matter is this. Each one of us in this room was born a mutant. The genetic code labored for 2 billion years, continually checking the market for what was needed, continually sending out RNA messengers to see what the energy system is in the planet now. And they rolled you off the Detroit assembly line, perfect. Buddha. All potentialities were yours. And then what happened? My mother and father, and your mother and father, out of the goodness of their heart, sincerely went to work as quickly as they could to narrow us down, narrow us down, narrow us down. There's a good boy. There's a good girl. You'll grow up to be a nice American. And what was worse, at the tender age of 5 or 6, and again, with the best of intentions, they sent us out of the home and put us in the hands of drug pushers, narcotic, addictive drug pushers who hung around our primary schools. The drugs are the tribal symbols, and the connections are teachers. Now, 60 years ago, a fellow member of my trade union by the name of William James was teaching at Harvard. Same old story. He had a chemical, and he was running nitrous oxide parties in the back bay. Eyebrows were lifted. In the Varieties of Religious Experience, one of the great American texts, William James talks about the effects of nitrous oxide with poetry and enthusiasm, which dwarfs anything that we wrote about LSD when we were at Harvard. But the time wasn't ready, because William James lived in a relatively free society. And those of you who are under the age of 25 perhaps have no idea how society has zipped up and become an anthill and a robot assembly line just in the last 15 or 20 or 30 years. You know, in the time of William James, there were no fingerprints, there were no identity and social security cards. This country was a collection of hundreds and thousands of fascinating and interesting groups developing kind of independent ways of life. You could travel much more freely. A psychologist or a scientist was a gentleman scholar pursuing, as our profession has for thousands of years, the meaning of life, the meaning of human nature, how to relieve suffering. The idea of government research grants, or that you couldn't do research without federal approval, or that you might be doing research for the Department of the Military. Now, come on. This was a nightmare that even William James's nitrous oxide sessions could hardly predict. The time has come, we think. But in order to make the next move, not only does the society have to be ready, but you have to have a method, a new method for bringing man back to his senses and turning him on and tuning him in. Now, in our profession, we usually call these methods for turning man on to his divinity sacraments. What is a sacrament? A sacrament is a visible, tangible method of finding grace, a visible, tangible method for turning on. Ooh, but it's dangerous. Right. The sacrament is always dangerous. If it's not dangerous, it doesn't work. But what is it dangerous to? What does it imperil? Well, you can be sure of this. The new sacrament imperils the old regime. And it imperils that part of your mind which is hooked to the old static canned regime. Now, let me tell you something about some turn-on methods of the past. 4,000 years ago, in the mountains of northern India, there were a group of men who discovered something called soma. They took this plant or chemical, and they sat down and they wrote the Vedas. The Vedic philosophy is the basis of all Western and Eastern philosophy and epistemology. It's never been surpassed. Americans, Westerners today, are just beginning to catch on to the problems that were solved 4,000 years ago by this Vedic philosopher. But then what happened? The same old sequence. Within 1500 years, the society which is known as the Brahmanical Society had it all pigeonholed, labeled, and canned, and computerized. The caste system, the priestly rituals. It was a very tight society. And then the ferment started again. And all over India, and even in China, a new psychedelic method was worked out by men, or perhaps groups of men that we now know as Buddha or Laozi. Interestingly enough, this method might be called the sit-in. The Buddha went to the Bo tree and sat under it. He had tried the yogic philosophies. He'd tried the Vedic philosophies. He'd been a Brahmin with the cord and burned the incense and done all the incantations. They didn't work. He sat under the tree and said, I'm not going to move until I make it. And after 49 days and 49 nights, as the legend tells us, he got it. He started the new round. Much more recently, the medieval society got pretty uptight. It was all worked out. You know, you bought grace with money, and you bribed a lawyer, and he was going to get you to heaven, and it was all hierarchy, computerized. And then Luther said, you know, look, it's just man and God. That's all. That's all it ever is. And his technique, his turn on, the printing press. The only thing that can get man to God was that Bible. Do you hear that down in Rome? Yeah, they hear it. Today, the psychedelic method is chemical. Does that seem surprising to you? It shouldn't. In the first place, embarrassing as this might be to our academic and scholarly aspirations, consciousness is a biochemical phenomenon. Learning is biochemical, memory is biochemical, forgetting is biochemical, sensing is biochemical. Nothing that goes on makes any sense. The whole business is a shuttling of molecules interacting with nerve cells. And how can it be surprising that the next sacrament is going to be chemical? And we're a completely chemical society. The food on our table is made possible by chemicals. Our clothing is made possible by chemicals. We move around, pushed by chemicals, petrol, jet fuel. And we stay alive with medicine, chemicals. We use chemicals for every secular and profane goal. Isn't it natural that we'd finally get around to using chemicals to do that most important thing of all, to accelerate, expand, deepen meaning? And people say, well, you can't be serious. You can't find a religious experience with something artificial, like a chemical. So I say, well, now, LSD comes from morning glory seeds and a rust on rye. And marijuana is a weed. And mescaline comes from the peyote cactus. How do you turn on? Oh, the Bible, organ music, pews in a church. How long have they been around? And what's, you can't have a spiritual experience, something that comes from the outside. That's the very nature of a sacrament. We don't worship psychedelic drugs. You don't say that LSD is God. Psychedelic drugs are sacraments. They're the visible external things that trigger off the key. Now, you can't understand psychedelic drugs unless you understand that there are many different chemicals which affect consciousness. There are many levels of consciousness, and there are specific chemicals which can move consciousness in one direction or another. In order to understand the effect of chemicals on consciousness, you have to have some sort of a model or a metaphor for mapping out the different levels of consciousness. Every new sacrament requires a new metaphor. You can't use the old model, the old theology, for the new vision and the new method. Now, when the Buddha was under the tree and he worked out the technique of meditation, turning off the mind, turning off the outside world, turn on. And by the way, if any of you would like to have an LSD experience and you don't want to take the drug, just go outside in a mountain and just sit there for 5, 10, 15 days and nights without eating, without sleeping, without being assailed by television or anything social. And I guarantee you, you'll have your LSD experience. If that hasn't been made illegal. Now what happened after the Buddha had his flash? He sat under that tree and of course he saw what was involved. He's going to have to go back to the Brahmins and say, look boys, you know, was it worth it? He said, yeah, it's the duty of our profession. You know, it would be much easier to just stand under that tree and spin through time. But no, he pulled himself up and he hiked to Benares on the banks of the sacred river. He went out to the deer park at Sarnath and he held a press conference. He said, ladies and gentlemen of the press, I announce there are four noble truths and an eightfold pathway. That was the new metaphor, the new method, the new psychology. Today, those of us who use the psychedelic sacraments don't talk about purgatory and heaven and hell. We don't use the Tibetan Buddhist psychological system, which is a highly refined and sophisticated method, by the way. We don't use the metaphor of Gurdjieff and Uspensky and the scholars of the last generation, nor do we talk, as Carl Jung, another member of our profession, did just a few years ago, about archetypes and collective consciousness. We use the metaphor from which our new sacrament springs, the language of science. Now, LSD is like a microscope, and when they first discovered the microscope, you know, you look through the microscope, and here was a world which was invisible, which had nothing to do really with the objects, the macroscopic events out here, entirely new level of reality. How are you going to talk about it? How are you going to describe it? The temptation always is to use the metaphor of the old language. You look through the microscope and say, ooh, they're all bugs. You say, ooh, there's my mother-in-law. See, that doesn't work. The new vision, the new psychedelic method, which brings reality into focus, demands a new language. We don't talk in parables. We talk in the language of science. We say there are 6 or 7 levels of consciousness, and there are biochemicals which affect each of these. If you want to get into a stupor, and there are times when you want to get in a stupor, take a sleeping pill, or take our popular national narcotic, alcohol. If you want to get along with ordinary reality, you're at the level of symbols. Almost every American, when he gets up in the morning, is a little stuporous, and the first thing he does is take a chemical that jazzes him up enough so he can jump in the car and go down to the office. Caffeine, or the real high-powered operators will take a pep pill. Now, these two levels, stupor and symbol, are the, for the most part, the repertoire of the average American. But there are many other levels of consciousness, equally accessible and much more meaningful, available and reachable with the right chemical. The lowest level of psychedelic consciousness is the level of sense organs. Turn on your eye. William Blake said, I don't look with my eye, I look through it. It's an incredible 2 billion year old retinal photographic light receiving piece of machinery. It takes you years of disciplined yoga to learn how to use your eye or your ear or your body. The next level, oh, by the way, this chemical which is specific to the level of senses, the chemical which polishes the lenses and brings the senses into focus is marijuana, or very low doses of LSD, maybe 25 or 50 gamma. The next level of consciousness is the level of somatic or physiological happenings. The average American would be more at home in Red Square in Moscow or Peiping than in that part of his brain which mediates the circulatory system, or the respiratory system, or the digestive system. But when you take moderate doses of a psychedelic sacrament, you find yourself spinning through your own body, which can be very frightening to the unprepared person. You know, even in Red Square, you can call for the Swiss Red Cross, but the unprepared person who is tumbling down his digestive system and caught in the ancient process of decomposition, there ain't no Red Cross there. The next level of psychedelic consciousness is what we call cellular. It is possible during psychedelic experiences to flip beyond your body, to confront terrains and vistas and energy transformations which you've never seen with your sense organs, and which are simply the recorded or molecular memory file cards of ancient processes which have been going on inside your cells and inside your body for thousands and millions of years. It may seem odd that we speak about listening to ourselves, but there's no problem that the human being faces or that you'll face in your life, social or political or sexual or whatever, that hasn't been worked out millions of times by that incredible blueprinting, architectural Detroit planning factory built inside every cell in your body. Now, there are lawful regularities, there are scientific processes, there are charts that have always been used by the members of my profession. We belong to a science. It's the real psychology, the psychology of taping and charting out consciousness. And just as the period after Columbus, man had to chart out the external geography of our planet, the members of our science have been obsessed for the last 4,000 years in charting the different levels, in recognizing, passing on, controlling, predicting what happens when you tumble down through your own cellular processes. There are regular, geographical, lawful areas inside your own nervous system. Now, let me tell you a story to illustrate this. I was first turned on by a psychedelic drug by my father at the age of 7. He was a dentist. I had to have a tooth extracted, and I remember going to his office, and I remember him putting the rubber mask over my mouth, and I saw his hand on this dial, and then, boom, I went off to another level of consciousness. Now, I don't remember now what I experienced. I do remember laughing quite a bit. But then I came out of it, and I could see his hand on the dial, and he took the mask off, and I got down off the chair and picked up my school books and went back to grammar school and so forth. Then, about 2 years ago, I was preparing to go to India, where I was going to study for 5 months with a very famous member of my profession called Lama Anagarika Govinda. And before I went, I had some fillings I had to have fixed in my teeth. I didn't want to have a toothache on the banks of the Ganges. So I went to a dentist in a nearby town, Poughkeepsie, and I had to go 13 or 14 times. And he used a consciousness-contracting narcotic drug called Novocaine. See, narcotic addictive drugs like alcohol and morphine, the opium derivatives, turn you off. You don't feel what you ordinarily would feel. So 13 or 14 times he drilled away. And then I had to go back one more time to just have a little scraping of the gums and a cleaning. But before I went back, Dr. Ralph Metzner, who has for many years been one of my colleagues, had a terrible toothache. And he rushed to the dentist. It turned out he had an impacted wisdom tooth and had about a 2-hour operation to get this out. And the dentist used gas. Now, Dr. Metzner had had LSD perhaps 100, 150 times, but I'll never forget the afternoon he came back from the dentist's office, and he came in the house, and he fell down on a couch, and he said, "Listen, forget LSD." So the next day, I went to the dentist. And I sat in the chair, and the doctor said, "Well, this is going to be very quick today. I won't use Novocaine. I'm just going to." I said, "Well, how about gas?" said, well, don't be silly, be no pain at all. I said, well, Dr. Metzner got to have gas. So I put the mask over my mouth, and his hand went on the dial. You see him turning it. He had black hair in his hand. I remember that very clearly. And zoom, I went off to another level of consciousness. And where did I go? I went right back to the dentist chair at the age of 7 in my father's office. And I laughed and I laughed because it was obvious to me that reality was the dentist chair. And that everything that had happened outside the dentist chair was a dream. It was a dream that I went to grammar school and to high school and to college and World War II and went to Harvard and left Harvard. An incredible dream. I was overwhelmed. Tears came to my eyes at the poignancy and the details of the dream, and chagrin at how seriously I took it all, and the acts of selfishness and of fear and of the lack of humor, and but yet the beauty of it, and the humanness of it, and the sincerity, albeit blind, of the way I did it all. If that's the way it is, I'll do it again. I mean, it's how strange, though, that the omnipotent power had black hair in his hands. But that's the way it comes. I could have done one thing, and for one moment I thought, well, I want to get back. I could rush out of the dentist chair, and then I could see myself out in the street with that little napkin, you know, around. And really, that was more untidy than the dream itself. So I said, thy will be done. So he took the mask off, and I looked at him, and I said, doctor, how long has this been going on? He said, what? And I said, well, I just had this incredible experience. Oh, yes, people have nightmares. They see animals and so forth, Now, this story, is very similar to the parable told by another member of my profession, and a great one, called Chongster. He was a Taoist philosopher in China. His story went like this. He dreamt one night he was a butterfly. And that was a shocking experience that he'd never get over, because from then on he'd never know whether he was a philosopher who dreamt he was a butterfly, or a butterfly who was talking philosophy. Now, there may be some humor in that, but that happens to be the neurological fact of the matter. The particular reality that we take for granted is simply one chessboard that was imposed upon us by the accident of our being born in this particular culture to this particular mom and dad. And we take it so for granted, as though this is the only one, whereas the facts of the matter are that you just tilt it just a little bit, and the whole thing goes off kilter, and is an entirely new reality. Tilt it a little more, and ooh, it gets so smooth and soft, and it's perfect. You realize that, it's all in your own mind. You can get it all flowing smoothly, or the other way, just a little bit off, and it's all jangling, and there are an infinity of realities. But in order to discover this, you have to climb out of the sticky black molasses, life-size chessboard that we're all trapped in, which we call normal mental thinking. And each level of reality, each territory in your nervous system that you move into, has its own reality, its own ontology, its own paranoias, its own ecstasies, its own fears, its own hopes. There are a million of them, easily available to the member of my profession. But you have to have maps, you have to have models, you have to have a language, you have to have teachers. Our profession is not an easy one. To learn to use this piece of machinery takes many more years than to learn like jet engines or computers or the machinery of Michigan State and federal government. This is the most complicated and delicate and intricate machine of all. Training, manuals, maps, practice, recording, observation, keeping notes, replicating your observation to somebody else, teaching somebody else how to do it. Oh yeah, it didn't happen, why not? Endless. But very exciting. The fourth characteristic, fourth factor that you have to have going for you to start a new religion is a proper political climate. You see, our profession goes on just like any other profession, generation after generation, century after century. Just as the physicist or the graduate student of physics knows there was Oppenheimer, and then there was Bohr, and then there was Einstein, and then there was Planck, and then there was Newton, and then there was Galileo. See, our profession has the same history. We have the same record of texts. We have the same models. We build upon the models and metaphors of the past. We use the methods of the past. And there are times of a breakthrough, and there are times when the whole thing is just underground, and we pass our books on from student to pupil, from guru to disciple, and so forth. The time to emerge, come above ground, is when the sickness of the society is so obvious that large segments of the society are just dealing themselves out of the game and are waiting. And the three groups that are always waiting for the new breakthrough are the young, the creative, and the socially alienated of that particular society. Now, we got that today. We have the sacrament. We've got the new metaphor, the language of science. And the political climate is really just almost ideal for the new breakthrough. It always plays out the same way. When you make the discovery, when you got the new sacrament ready, you don't go to Washington, and you don't go to Rome, and you don't go to the dean's office, or you don't go to the head of the department. What are you, crazy? You know, when Luther got his big hit, he didn't walk down to Rome and say, "Well, now, Mr. Pope, it's time to get off that throne, take off all those jewels, and here's the Bible. Reaffirm the divinity of the individual and do it yourself, and tell all those cardinals to come out of their palaces." It never works that way. It's the young, the creative, and the socially alienated. Now remember, society has to be zipped up in static to make it time to start, which is the paradox. Exactly at that point when society is so monolithic that you can't really move is the time the surge comes from underground. And the drama is always played out the same way, just like Notre Dame and Michigan State. You know, four downs and you punt, 15-yard penalties for holding. It's a tough game. I've been arrested 3 times in the last 9 months. Both of my children have been put in jail. We've had the midnight raid with the boots and the uniforms and the guns. Perfectly expected. If that didn't happen, I'd wonder, am I talking to nobody? I don't have one grain of anger or paranoia about the fact that it's the nature of my profession to be on the odds with the establishment. It's exactly like football. When your quarterback goes out on the field next Saturday, you can say, "Well, what is he? A rebellious nut?" I mean, here are the Notre Dame line weighs 285, something like that. You have 5 or 7 of them there. What is he? A masochistic freak? Is he looking for trouble? Is he an exhibitionist? That's the nature of the game. And when he gets thrown down and maybe a little knee twisting and they hit him a little harder than they should, there's hardly one pro football player that doesn't have a few teeth missing and no hard feelings. Matter of fact, every time I'm arrested, it gives me a chance to spend a day with the police. While I'm waiting to be bailed out, they talk to me and they argue, and I tell them, alcohol is a terrible drug, but they say, "Well, it's legal." And I say, "Yeah, well, it's a pretty lousy law." And then it always ends up, I give them a book and I autograph it for them, and we promise to write. have started a new religion. It's called the League for Spiritual Discovery. And the strategy, and again, this is just like, you know, it's all textbook. We start with the young. In 15 years, the undergraduate is the next district attorney. I mean, it's so obvious. 15 years changes the whole business. You pass the word on. It's never printed in Lifetime magazine. Reader's Digest won't touch it. The Roman Legionnaire's alumni magazine, wouldn't think of publishing it. It always passes on in song, in joke, in double meaning. I'm probably the only psychologist or ex-psychologist in the country today who's had a line from one of his books in a recorded song of the Beatles. Have you heard that new record, Revolver? It always passes through the marketplace, the slave ships, down in the Tenderloin, down in the the slave quarters, and it slowly begins to bubble up. The Roman matron wonders, why that slave, Flavia, seems so turned on all the time, so happy. What has she got going? You go down in that catacomb, and yeah, you celebrate a death-rebirth experience. Say, well, tell me a little bit more about it. Oh, yeah. Then she says to her husband, hey, you know, really, Flavia's got something going here. When I told you that your mothers and fathers did all these terrible things to you, I didn't mean that you should be angry or beat up on them. When you're spiritually ready to do so, I want you to go home and turn them on. Because that's how it's always been done. Every place I talk these days, it's a sellout crowd. There's incredible interest and enthusiasm. Now, I have no illusions. It has nothing to do with me that I'm that smart. I'm just playing out the role, and baby, they gave me the good lines. Turn on, tune in, drop out. And I didn't invent them. It's been said in every generation. It's in every one of the old books. And we just simply polish it up and pass it on. In addition to talking to the young, and in talking to creative artists, and in talking to the alienated minority groups in our country, particularly the racial groups, another thing we did very early in our work, and again, this is a standard strategy in our business, when you want to turn on society, we worked with that unit without which nothing can happen, and upon which everything grows, the unit of the family. Very early in our work at Harvard, we gave LSD to about 50 married couples. And by give LSD, I don't mean give, I mean give. We turned it over. We said, we want to find out how educated American couples will use a psychedelic drug in their normal way of life. The contract is, use it whenever you want to, but just keep a record. If you ever get any question, call us immediately, we'll come over, but just keep a record and file a record before you try it again. And we learned a tremendous amount about what these chemicals can do and how they can be woven in to the basic fabric of human life, the family, the male-female relationship, the relationship of parents to children. How do children react to LSD sessions? At what age do you give LSD to children? This may seem shocking if you think of LSD as a drug like alcohol, but this is a sacrament. It's the weekly trip to talk to divinity. Now, we have no interest, and indeed some resistance to the idea of institutionalizing the use of psychedelic drugs. I mean, it's incredible to us that anyone in their right mind could think of taking something like LSD or marijuana and say, we'll have a government-sponsored, federally controlled, psychiatrically supervised place where people can have a religious experience. I mean, that may make sense if you think of LSD as being a medicine, which it's not, or a dangerous narcotic, which it's not, but it's a way of turning on, of contacting meaning. It's the most intimate and to us sacred experience around, and it's got to be done, you know, in the shrine, with your family, with your closest friends, with people with whom you want to share these rare moments. Now, to us, the government sponsorship and research in LSD is just like government research into you know, the loss of virginity. Now, the problem is, as my guru Aldous Huxley pointed out in several of his books, the dictatorships that we have to fear in the future, the really alarming political developments that are coming along very rapidly, is not the dictatorship of the lash and the cross and the electric chair. That's untidy old business. The real danger from now on that's going to bring the anthill society to us is the dictatorship of the carrot, of the syrup, of the positive reinforcement, of the reward. Just get them coming along that way. And it's all done with the best of intentions and the highest ideals. It is not beyond the realm of fantasy to think that well-meaning officials of the public health department or the mental health division will be saying the same things about LSD that saying the same things about the sexual experience that they're saying about LSD. The motto of our religion is turn on, tune in, and drop out. By turn on, we mean learn how to use sacraments or methods which put you in touch with your cellular wisdom and your sense organs. And this is a very time-consuming practice. See, the problem is that in our society, the word drug, particularly to anyone over the age of 40, means one of two things. Drug, doctor, disease, prescription, doctor, disease, or drug, junkie, crime, dope addict, purse snatching, orgy, dope. Now, you just can't get anyone over the age of 40 to unhook these neurological connections. You just can't do it. It's a built-in neurological reflex. Drug doctor, drug dope fiend. So that everything we say makes absolutely no sense to anyone over the age of 40, 45. For example, I've said to every audience I've ever talked to, and I've said in every book or an article I've ever written, the use of marijuana and LSD requires a tremendous amount of training and practice and discipline, concentration. Now, that makes no sense to the person who thinks drug doctor, drug dope fiend. You see, with alcohol, any nut or any unprepared person can lurch down to the liquor store and for $5, $10 get a quart of whiskey and use it. And he'll pass out. Or anyone can take a needle full of heroin and stick it in his vein and he'll go off. You don't have to, there's no training course in that. But with the chemicals which expand consciousness, incredibly detailed and precise training is necessary. Most people who smoke marijuana in the United States today, and of course the millions of them, really don't know how to use it. It's built into funny kind of hipster rituals. Actually, the real use of marijuana means the use of your senses. It means arranging the environment, the energies, sound and light and touch and chemical and tissue and olfactory and taste very precisely so that what happens takes is a harmony of the possibilities which are unleashed when the senses are cleaned off. I know many couples who have spent 3 or 4 months in rehearsed practice for an LSD session in which they were going to find in their sexual relationship what men for thousands of years have found possible, the sex as a sacrament, sex as a way of going beyond yourself and unifying yourself with a member of the opposite sex. There are many manuals, you know, in tantric Buddhism and tantric Hinduism, which teach the adept how practice of study over months and years he can find divinity and meaning this way. Now, I've been talking about religion and sacraments and the spiritual experience. And now, ironically enough, at the conclusion of my talk, I want to define the terms I've been using. I want to define what I mean by man and God and law, or man and law and God and law. For thousands of years, my profession has been in an easy situation because of these issues. What is the relationship of church and state? What do we render to Caesar and what do we preserve for God? What is sacred and what is profane? And what laws can separate and organize these two events? It's actually very simple. And I'm going to give you a formula which I think will help you understand and make sense out of this anguishing problem. The law of man, the law of society, the law of Caesar governs what happens outside of your body. What you do in the street, what you do in public, what you do with money, what you do with territory, what you do with instruments and objects that are visible and tangible. We all agree they have to be laws. We just can't run amok on the highways. We just can't grab anything we want. We can't injure each other. There have got to be laws of navigation and motor vehicles and finance and domestic relations and territory. And there are well-rehearsed techniques for changing laws. There are many Caesars, and you can join this Caesar or that Caesar and fight to change the external environment if you want to. And all that has to do with society and has nothing to do with the religious experience. And anything that's out there tangible in the way of territory or school buses or anything is a profanation. It has nothing to do with, it's secular, it has nothing to do with the internal experience. Now, the territory of God, the kingdom of heaven, here man's law cannot intrude. And what is the territory of heaven? What are the limits and boundaries of God's empire? Your body. The skin of your body are the frontiers of heaven. And the gateways to Eden are your sense organs, your eye, your ear, your touch, your orifices. Well, if the territory of God is in your body and the kingdom of heaven is there, who is God? I am God, and you are God. I am God only in the territory of my divinity. I can create any universe I want within my own body, within my own nervous system. But because I am God there, it doesn't allow me to walk out into the street and order people around, or tell people what to do, or tell any of you how to run your heaven, because by the same token, you are God within the limits of your divinity. Now, in American culture, and for that matter in the West, the man that goes around saying, I am God, is very likely to get in trouble. You know, go home and tell your wife, or you tell your roommate, you know, I'm God. Well, doctor, can you come over right away? You could insist on repeating this too often, they'll send you away. This, of course, comes because of the confusion of what's external and social and what's internal and divine. You have no business imposing your divinity on anything out there, but don't let anyone rob you of your divinity. Now, in the East, or in other times in human history, if a man said, I am God, you know, his neighbor would say, good for you, congratulations, you finally caught on. The greeting, the normal standard greeting of saying hello in India today is namaste, namaste. I greet the divinity within you. I mean, you know, they're onto something that we could learn a lot about. Now, specifically, problem occurs with that uneasy territory between what's external, what's internal, particularly those things that can affect consciousness, which can affect your divinity and your universe of realities. What things should strike the retina of your eye and thus change your consciousness? It's your business, and only your business, what strikes the retina of your eye. Now, you have no business forcing other people to look at what you want them to look at. But nobody has the right to tell you what you can look at, or what hits your ear, or what goes into your body, or what touches your body. And laws which govern sexual behavior, just as far as your body is concerned, or which have to do with drugs or chemicals which go inside your body and change your consciousness, are illegal. Profanations and intrusions of Caesar upon the divine. And of course, there are plenty of such laws, or even laws about suicide. It's well known in the history of divinity that there are certain times when Vishnu, after going through thousands of reincarnations, wants to turn the button off and have a sleep for a while. If I want to commit suicide and bring about that change within my own universe, whether I want to do it through nicotine or through cyanide, it's my business. And certainly, chemicals which affect consciousness are nobody's business but mine and yours. Now, if I take LSD or marijuana and walk out in the street and break some law of Caesar's, if I smash up a car, or if I rip off my clothes and paint the buildings purple, if I burst into other people's homes and announce I'm God, arrest me. I willingly go, because that's Caesar's territory. And we got plenty of laws to govern what we do outside. We have no shortage of that particular commodity. Now, one other thing which has to be said about your own divinity and the sacraments and the controls of your kingdom of heaven. Where do you practice your religion? Can a Gentile and a Jew make love? There are certain societies where that's against the law. I think they should be able to make love. But not in the football stadium, or not in the kindergarten. Can I smoke marijuana, take LSD? That's my business, as long as I do it in my home and my shrine. But I certainly would never recommend, indeed urge you not to take LSD and go to the football game, or rush through the streets, or drive a car. For thousands of years, men have known in their wisdom that we have to have places called shrines. Now, what is a shrine? A shrine is a place that's devoted to nothing but the spiritual experience. You can't do anything in the shrine. Get the money changers out, right. The shrine is a place where no games are played except the game of going beyond the game and moving within. And for thousands of years in civilized cultures, the shrine was the place where you could go and Caesar's law couldn't come in. You can't make counterfeit money in your shrine. If you do that, you've broken the rule. You've taken Caesar's game and brought it inside. The rule goes both ways. But in the privacy of your shrine, or our shrine, our religion is asking to be licensed so that our guides can import and distribute psychedelic sacraments only to our initiates and only in their shrines. Your body and the consciousness, which is controlled by alterations in the chemistry of your body, is the last frontier of freedom. I urge you to guard it carefully. Now, I have at times today talked frivolously, attempted to be humorous. I want to explain that although I may speak in jest, I'm quite serious about what we're doing and what we intend. But if you take the game, the tribal game, seriously, you make a bad joke of life. And if you take life seriously, then the game is fun and play. I also tend to jest because I'm on the winning side. Our side always wins because we always work with the three groups that are going to take over society in the next 20 years. The young, the artists, who are just coming into their power in 15 to 20 years, and the minority groups moving and pushing up. Let me illustrate this for you, because there's this quarrel between the generations, this breakdown of communication between the generation over 40 and the generation under 30, which is incredible that we don't learn from history. Do you know that as certain as I'm standing here, in 20 years, at least half of the Supreme Court and half of the judiciary of the United States are going to be pot smokers? I'll bet you on that. Now, if that sounds shocking, think back 40 years. Now, you think of the present Supreme Court as gentlemen with white hair, and gavels, and black robes. What were they doing 40 years ago? They were rollicking around in tin lizzies, in raccoon skin coats, drinking an illegal drug out of hip flasks, and wrestling with flappers. Can't any generation catch on that the cycle continues? Will your generation catch on? Because just as certainly as I'm standing here, in your lifetime, you will see the next sacrament. See, it used to take 1,000 years, 700 years, 500 years for the word to spread. Today, we announce on a press conference at 10 o'clock a new religion. At 10:10, it's on the ticker in London, 10:15 on the ticker in Tokyo, 10:17 on the ticker in Beijing, and they're wondering, what the hell's going on now? See, it all happens very fast now. You're going to see in your lifetime the LSD orthodoxy and the LSD high priesthood and the LSD commissions, and you're going to see the new sacrament. It'll probably be electronic brain stimulation. You punch a few buttons and it'll flip you down your genetic code and you can reincarnate very quickly. And you're going to hear LSD commissioners say, this new technique is causes suicide, is dangerous, causes orgies, psychosis, and must be stopped. You will probably hear my name invoked to put down the next generation of visionaries. Don't let it happen. The challenge is that you can accept the canned, static, programmed, computerized symbols and roles of this society and run through architecture, through zoology, play it out, assistant professor, full professor, pension, security, insurance, bye. Or you have within you the whole business. The challenge is you be the Messiah, you be Galileo, you be Copernicus, you struggle like Moses in the dark night where there's no ethical thing and hammer it out on some tablet of stone of your own. I mean, it's got to be done every generation. Do you think it was all done 2,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago? Come on. You've got to do it. Don't settle for less. I salute the God within you.
I don't think I have to say any more than that. We'd just like to thank Dr. Lurie for coming here. On behalf of Bob Rosen and Jim Kouzis, co-chairman of Great Issues, and you, thank you, Dr. Lurie. Gary, take your speech.